Today's podcast is brought to you by the Herzog Foundation. At the tender age of 12, a confused Chloe Cole was swept up in gender ideology. This belief system told her that if she was unhappy, it must be that she was born in the wrong body. She tells her harrowing story of a transition and now a detransition. Plus, we'll also hear from a doctor following the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm and some very interesting findings on the COVID vaccine. It's a packed show. Stay with us. This is the Moms for America podcast. Each week, leaders and everyday champions tell personal stories, share advice, and tackle the issues most important to moms. Hi, moms. I'm Debbie Karolaitis, your host, and welcome to the Moms for America podcast. I'm so glad that you're joining us again this week. Every episode, we get together to inspire, encourage, and educate moms in their journey through motherhood. Well, today, it is packed with information. Today, we're bringing you three more fascinating interviews that I did at CPAC. The first one here is Chloe Cole. Now, Chloe is a bold, you'll understand why, a truth-telling activist who opposes what is called gender-affirming care for minors. She arrived at this position based on her own personal experience with this kind of medical care, which began in her adolescence. Here's Chloe. We are delighted to have this young woman on because she has been a voice at a time when it was very difficult to talk about this subject. Welcome, Chloe Cole, to the Moms for America podcast. Thanks for joining us. We've been wanting to talk to you for a long time.
Well, I'm glad we finally got to talk. Thanks for having me.
All right. I know most of our moms heard your story, and it's probably hard to wrap this up because it's been a journey for you, right? At 12 years old, you came out to your parents, is that correct? And you said, I want to transition to a boy.
Yes, I told them that I wanted to be their son rather than their daughter when I was 12 years old. After years of going through a bit of an early puberty, being a tomboyish girl, having a learning disability, and never really feeling like I could fit in or relate to my female role models or the women or girls around me.
Right.
And all this culminated to me feeling like my source of unhappiness was really because I wasn't supposed to be a woman, but instead I was a young man who happened to be born in the body of a young woman. Right. And I went through the medical stages of the transition process between the ages of 12 to 16.
Let me just ask you real quick. As you were leading up to this at 12 to tell your parents, did they have any idea? Was this a big discussion at home? Was this something done in private? I want to address that because a lot of our kids now are dealing with this maybe in private, online, with teachers at school. Were you discussing this at home, or was this kind of not a topic to discuss? I don't know the answer to that, and I'd like to know.
My mom and dad, they didn't really know anything about this subject at all, and they had no idea what I was seeing online that pertained to it. I had gotten my first phone when I was 11 or 12, and that was where I started primarily being exposed to this. But my mom and dad, it was something that we never talked about until I started having these feelings.
Yeah, how do you tell your parents, I feel like I'm a boy, really? You know, and this is a hard discussion to say to a parent, and a parent knows that they birthed a girl.
Yeah.
You know, so they're
very
confused.
For us.
Not only are you confused, parents are confused, obviously, to watch this. So now you come out with them at 12. Where does this journey lead you?
So they did not want to push me down any particular path. They didn't believe that I was a boy. They knew that I wasn't their son. But they wanted to allow me to express myself and be comfortable within, I mean, just normal boundaries for a child, like clothing, hair, nothing beyond that.
Did you change your name at that time with them?
Yeah, I asked them to refer to me by the name Leo.
Leo.
Yeah.
Okay.
I actually specifically chose my name so that it wouldn't, I just took like a few letters out of my birth name so that it wouldn't deviate too much from that. Out of respect for my mom and dad.
Chloe to Leo. Okay, makes sense.
But they decided that they were going to have me see a therapist because they didn't really know why I was feeling this way.
Right.
Or where these feelings were coming from. So they thought, well, I mean, it'll probably help to maybe have a professional weigh in on this. But unfortunately, it really didn't. We were separated during appointments. They were not allowed to be in the room with me as I was speaking to the therapist.
Now, why was that? At 12 years old, you're considered an adult? I mean, this is happening across the
country. California, yes. Yeah. In California, you are considered legally emancipated to speak to a psychologist without either the knowledge or consent or just the involvement of
your
parents.
Think about that. And I know a lot of parents don't believe this is happening, but it is happening at that. In Illinois, I think if you're over 11 or 12 years old, you have to give your parents consent on your my chart to let them into this. So
yep.
They're excluded from the process. Now, these counselors, these doctors have you without any other counsel.
I mean, I already had the mind virus at this point.
Okay.
I already believed that I was a boy because of influence from the internet and because of the communities that I was browsing online. But they only affirmed it. They only told me, yes, you are a boy. Yes, these feelings are real. And we are going to refer you as such. And so are your mom and dad. And we're not going to expect any less from them. Mm.
Okay, so wow. So mom and dad get now faced with, we're going boy. And you're going to accept it.
Yeah, and they try to push back.
Yeah.
They try to talk some sense into me. And they also tried to talk to my therapist at the time as well. And what they were told was that this was just a part of me, that it wasn't going to go away, that I wasn't going to grow out of it. It wasn't just a phase. But that there are notably high suicide rates, or at least rates of suicidality or attempts in this population of people.
Sure.
And these doctors will misattribute that to either a lack of social acceptance, bullying, or a lack of medicalization while young. And so they really hung this over my mom and dad's heads and basically convinced them that
if they don't do it, that you'll probably kill yourself.
Yes.
If they don't get on board. And we've heard that. Would you like a live son or a dead daughter?
That's
right?
The ultimatum that they present to every single parent.
Terrifying.
And they basically only give the options of transition or death.
So now mom and dad, family gets around you.
They feel trapped.
Yeah. What do they do? They said yes?
Mom and dad said yes because it was the only option that our family was given.
And obviously you're very committed to the transition too, so you've got you, the medical, the counselors, everyone saying you have to let me do this, you have to let this happen.
Yes, and I mean, I was stubborn as 12-year-old children tend to be.
Right.
And I feel like just my natural naivety.
Right.
And
you're a child.
My innocence was being taken advantage of.
Right.
Every kid is sure of themselves.
At 12, if we went with what 12-year-olds or 10-year-olds or 13-year-olds thought was it, they thought they could rule the world. I mean, because they get this confidence.
Yes, every child feels like they're invincible. Most children have never had to deal with death before in any way. And they've certainly never had to deal with permanence.
Yeah.
I didn't understand what permanent meant, and I didn't know that it was possible for me to even regret this or be harmed by it.
Right, you couldn't see the future, you didn't understand the future.
No child can.
No, absolutely, and that's why this is so upsetting all across the country that things like this are happening and we don't get good counselors and good options and good authorities to speak to this. So so now you start the puberty blockers, you've now changed your name.
Yes, so the medical interventions began at 13 years old for me with puberty blockers and testosterone. To block my puberty, they put me on a chemical castration and cancer drug called Lupron, which has actually been subject to many, many, many different lawsuits because of how horrific it is to be on. And I basically went on to an artificial menopause during the time that I was on it. So I was experiencing all the side effects of menopause while I was still an eighth grader. And then they put me on testosterone to partly to mitigate some of that, but also to cause changes to masculinize my body, my face, my voice.
I can't imagine what you were feeling everywhere.
It was intense. I was experiencing
hormones
intense changes
like
not only in my body, physically and cosmetically, but also behaviorally and down to the way that I thought and experienced emotions. So it was just a radical change for me in every single way.
Sure.
By the time that I entered my high school years, I looked like a young boy. So pretty much everybody in my life throughout most of my teenage years knew me as a young man. And as an adult now, I'm still like trying to assess just the psychological damages of that alone.
Right.
I'm still experiencing the side effects from all three of the treatments that I received.
Oh, but I'm sure.
I'm still processing everything that I went through because it took up pretty much the entire half of my childhood.
Right. Your teenage years where you should be enjoying school and friendships and all of these wonderful experiences, you are caught.
It was just completely perverted in every single way. And at 15 years old was when I underwent my only surgery during this time, which was a double mastectomy. Now, these are most.
What age was it when you did the double mastectomy?
I was 15, so I couldn't even drive a car yet.
15 years old.
I couldn't drive a car, but I could get my breast.
And they were just willing to push this agenda on you.
It was very straightforward, yeah. There was no real questioning or counseling during this time. It was just accepted that I was a young man. And my mom and dad, they knew that this was incredibly radical for me to undertake as a little girl. So they pushed back against all of this. But they were told that every step of the way, it's life or death for your daughter, essentially.
Right.
So they felt pressured into saying yes to this. Right. Under threat of what I think is one of the most primal, most basic, and yet most distressing fears a parent could ever experience.
I can't speak for them, but I'm sure they wanted to protect you and love you, accept you. All of these emotions, as a parent, they just want the best for you, even if they don't agree with you. But if the professionals are telling them, you either do this or it's over, it's so frustrating. It's so frightening. And this is still happening.
Yes.
I mean, this is still happening every day in America. So now you get both of your breasts removed. You have no idea what that means long term. You have don't know what permanent means.
No. And I was, at every step of the way, I was being celebrated by my other transgender friends and my friends who called themselves, like, allies.
Right.
So, naturally, I thought this was the right path. And
right.
Every child, every teenager wants to appease the people around them. And
you found this community.
Yes.
Yeah.
And especially as an awkward neurodivergent girl who didn't always fit in, it felt like I finally found my place.
Right.
But after the surgery, I started to question everything. I started to realize that I was missing some simple normal. Normality.
Right.
Some of the basic things about femininity, wearing makeup, dresses, feeling like I could be cute, pretty. But I also started to think about my future too, because I was 15 going on 16,
yeah.
And legally adulthood was not that far away.
Right.
And I started thinking about, okay, what if I want to have kids one day? What if one day I get married and I decide to have a family of my own?
Right.
How am I going to do that when I'm on testosterone?
Right.
I don't know if I've been sterilized because of how young I was and I was put on these treatments.
Right.
And if my children are at risk of any birth defects. But psychologically, how is me being a woman acting or trying to fulfill the role of a man going to affect my children? How am I going to explain that I'm not mom, but I'm their second father, and I'm actually biologically a woman to them? Is that going to damage them in any way?
And what I'm hearing from you, Chloe, is you can't communicate it to someone else because you can't figure it out yourself.
No. I mean, it was, it's confusing. These feelings were confusing enough for me on their own, but I also had issues with communicating and just being able to verbalize these feelings
because
of my learning disability.
And depression,
I think what really knocked down the whole house of cards for me was the epiphany that I was never going to have my breast again, that I never would be able to breastfeed. I just learned in a class of mine how integral that is to the relationship between mother and child. And that left me heartbroken.
Wow.
And I would look at myself in the mirror and think, I'm never going to feel like I'm pretty ever again. This has affected me permanently. I have these big scars where my breasts used to be. I look like a man. At the time, I had the voice of a young man. And I thought, I'm never going to come back from this.
Right.
But I knew that something had to change, that I couldn't keep doing this to myself.
By the way, you look beautiful.
Thank you.
You really do.
I never thought that I would feel beautiful ever again.
I just want you to know that just looking at you, you're just radiant and you're just gorgeous.
Thank you.
What an incredibly heartbreaking wake-up call this was for 16-year-old Chloe. After the break, her story continues. Chloe will talk about her decision to detransition. And also, Dr. Jared Ross will talk about ridding the medical establishment of gender ideology and DEI. We'll be right back. Hi, moms. I'm excited to share some news about our new sponsor, the Herzog Foundation. We know you're passionate about raising patriots and empowering your children with the best education possible. And the Herzog Foundation shares that passion. They're dedicated to promoting liberty through education freedom and helping parents like you choose the best educational path. They offer a powerhouse of resources designed to support families and schools alike. Whether you're ready to dive in headfirst to the world of education or simply looking for more ways to empower your child's learning. From free training events to their must-read online publication, The Lion, they're committed to keeping you informed about what's happening in education. Also, if you've ever thought, moms, about starting your own Christian school or co-op, their School Box online course will give you everything you need to get started on the right foot. Again, we are so proud to partner with the Herzog Foundation, and we encourage you to explore all their amazing tools and the insights that they offer. So go ahead, visit herzogfoundation.com to learn more. You won't want to miss these incredible resources. Again, find it all out at herzogfoundation.com.
You know, I've never really felt comfortable sharing pictures of my kids on social media. Tubu, a premium social app with an actual authentic community. No bots, no one trolling me or my family. Just clean, wholesome content you can trust.
For the moms of Moms for America out there, Car Your Miracle really truly helped me out personally, and I could see that. But it also helped my mom out, it helped my wife out, it helped my sister out, it helped my friends out. I've really seen the benefits, and this is a time for healing our bodies, our minds, and our souls. And Car Your Miracle has done that for me, and I think it also can do it for our moms. Head to our link, cardiomiracle.com/moms, for a discount and to get started today.
All right. Welcome back, moms. Before we continue with our incredible interviews here, I'd like to invite all of you to like, subscribe, and also to share this podcast with your moms, your friends, and your circles. Boy, is this a topic that needs to be addressed? So important, as girls and boys are making incredible decisions that will forever change their lives. So moms, please go ahead, share this. Also, if you have an idea or a topic for our podcast, go ahead and email me directly at podcast@momsforamerica.net. I would love to hear from you, any of your suggestions, and also any of your feedback, please. All right. Lastly, I want to invite all of our moms listening. Have you joined the movement here at Moms for America? I sure hope so. We are the ultimate support group here. We are here to help support you on your journey through motherhood. It's moms like us uniting all across the country to fight for faith, family, freedom, and the Constitution. All you do is you go to momsforamerica.us, sign up for our newsletter, join the movement there. We have so many incredible resources, seminars, webinars, brochures, booklets, podcasts, everything that would help you right there in your home, parenting your children. Well, in part one of my interview with Chloe Cole, she talked about how she was infected with what she calls it the woke mind virus, which obviously led to her having a double mastectomy at the tender age of 15. Now, in part two, she talks about her regret and her mission as she speaks out all across the country against gender-affirming care. Take a listen.
So God has restored you. God has restored you. And you're on a journey to share this message, because once you made the switch, at what age and when did you say, I've got to speak out about this? Because you started detransitioning then, right? Back.
It was very quickly afterward. It was about probably less than a year after I had stopped taking hormones and everything. And I felt so compelled to, because I had young children coming to my family at the time. And it was kind of like my first outside look at innocence and how wonderful it is and how it has to be protected.
Right.
And how in our country, it's almost like it's a virtue that we've lost, the protection of our children.
Right.
And I also knew that I wasn't alone, because I kept encountering these other detransitioned men and women. And I felt like I had a community to speak for.
Yes.
And other people to advocate for, not just myself.
But you really, as far as I know, you're one of the very first ones in that age group at that time that said, I am going to share my story.
Yeah.
And I am going back to who God originally made me.
I mean, it helped that I was still a child at the time that I started speaking.
Right.
But I was the only person I was the only detransitioned woman who was publicly speaking out, who had gone through the process when she was still a child.
So when you decide to do that, you've got to go mom and dad, family, I'm going back to who I was. Mom and dad are now behind you there.
There was a lot of relief. A lot of guilt that they felt. But I don't blame them at all. I don't blame them for what happened. I think that they deserve grace, and that pretty much every parent who's dealing with this deserves grace and forgiveness, because for most people, it catches them completely by surprise, and it's hard to know what to do
right.
when your child is going through this, especially when you have all the odds and all the other adults stacked against you.
Right.
Because it's not natural.
It's
not something that we've had to deal with.
Can you share with our moms some advice for them if their child comes to them? I've heard a lot of people give advice. Don't ever let them change their names. Don't affirm their name.
Yes.
Get them in the right counseling. Don't let them all those things. I'd like for you to let our moms know, if somebody's coming to them, their child, they don't have to ride this with them. They can stop it. And legislate, now we've got President Trump. We don't have this wild ride of everyone pushing all the craziness. Now everybody's talking about things a little bit more normal, common sense. What would you say to our moms?
You do not have to, and really you should not affirm this in any capacity.
Right.
But I think it's okay to let your child express themselves through through benign means, such as the way that they dress and do their hair and their mannerisms, for example. Because I think that's a normal part of growing up and going
right.
through adolescence. Everybody is trying to explore their identity through this.
Right. And just because you want to play softball, wear a ponytail and baggy jeans doesn't mean that you're going to be a boy.
It's a normal part of development
right.
for many girls and for many boys. But you know your child best.
Right.
Do not let any adult tell you who your child is, because you know how they were created, how they were born.
Yes.
And
your baby.
for most women, I mean, most people yeah. have their children biologically, and they don't adopt. But they went through that process of gestating and giving birth to their child, and you know how your child was born.
Right.
So help your child to build their identity through that lens.
Right.
While letting them have some leeway on the way that they express themselves, but also guide them to build their identity through other means than just the way that they were born, or the way that they look, or their body is, or what they call themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You should help them to build their identity and understand themselves through the lens of who they make themselves to be, the things that they do, the skills that they have, the things that they do for the family and
right.
for the community.
Right. And your testimony, your journey is all over YouTube, right? So they can have their sons or daughters listen to your story. What's the future looking like for you now? What are you championing? What's your message as you're going across the country right now?
My ultimate message is that children are beautiful the way that they are, with everything they have that makes them unique, whether they feel like it's a flaw or not. And I think that everybody grows into their own elements if they're just given the chance. And that's exactly what we have to offer these children. We cannot allow them to undergo these permanent mutilative treatments. We have to be allowed, as parents, as adults, to say no.
Yes.
Because to do this to a child is completely abusive. And I think that we need a overall blanket ban on this treatment, not only state by state, but federally, because right now it's a state by state issue, but that makes it so that states like my home state of California are allowed to go further into the opposite direction, ripping children away from their families.
Right, they're going to take the child away from the home, everything.
Leading them down a path that is going to shorten their lives eventually.
Right. We have no idea what the puberty blockers are going to do when you switch someone's, right?
Absolutely.
We have no.
So I want to ensure that what happened to me, what happened to many of my friends, and what's happening to hundreds of thousands of children every day will never happen ever again.
Well,
I hope that one day I'm able to return to a normal life in some way and have children and a family of my own and get married.
I'm praying for you.
Thank you.
Really praying for you, because I know God will get you where you're supposed to be. And he has guided you so far. And you are stunning. You're beautiful. You have a great future in front of you. When you speak the truth sets you free.
Absolutely.
And the smile on your face, and you are confident in who you are now. It doesn't mean, like any of us, we don't have a journey we're going through. It doesn't mean we're perfect. But legislation, I know you want to see legislation protecting children, giving parents their parental rights and authority back.
And not just legislation. We need to have federal courts uphold this so that it cannot be reversed.
That's right. That's right. And President Trump, I do believe, he's starting to really make this a huge priority right away.
I'm confident.
You're confident. I know you've been speaking to him and everybody else on this. So anything else you want to share, Chloe? Thank you so much.
Well, I'm just really grateful that you guys have given me the opportunity to talk about this. It's something that really,
so
this is something that means everything to me.
Yeah.
And it absolutely needs to be covered.
Yeah.
It's voices like mine, the people who have been affected by this, the detransitioners, the children, the men and women who have assisted, and especially the parents and the families who have been affected by this, need their voices heard.
Yeah. We're going to protect our kids. We're going to keep them in their lane as God created them, male and female, and just help them in that journey. If we can get kids through those preteen years and those teenage years, they grow out of it. They're going to be okay.
And it's not easy, but it's ultimately a necessary part of everybody's development.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Obviously, Chloe is an amazing, brave young woman. We so appreciate you speaking out all across the country, sharing your story. We so admire and respect you, Chloe. Now, Chloe and others like her would have been so much better served if they had doctors that were part of this next organization called Do No Harm. Our next guest is an emergency medicine physician and a senior fellow at Do No Harm. Now, this organization represents those in the medical community who are focused on keeping identity politics out of medicine. Isn't that revolutionary? They seek to highlight and counteract divisive trends in medicine, such as DEI and youth-focused gender ideology. Take a listen to this.
Doctor, tell us a little bit about Do No Harm. I've heard of it because of January Littlejohn. I know she's on your parents' advisory board because her daughter had a situation, and I know you really have been very vocal about educating and protecting. So tell us about the mission of Do No Harm.
Yeah, January's amazing. She really does some wonderful work with the organization.
Moms, yeah.
And I've had the pleasure to work very closely with her, including at the Scrimeti rally here in D.C. in December. Do no harm. We saw the harm that was being done to medicine, how medicine was captured by these radical ideologues on the gender front, which you talked about as well as this new racism, DEI, injecting identity politics into every part of medicine. And so we created Do No Harm to restore medicine back to the Hippocratic Oath.
Yes.
Primum non nocere, first do no harm.
First do no harm. And of course, sterilizing a child is very harmful.
Very harmful. So we focus on two main issues.
Okay.
As you mentioned, protecting children from this radical gender ideology, from this idea that children can pick their sex or change their sex, protecting them from the danger of puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and these mutilative sterilizing surgeries. And then we also work on restoring merit to medicine, making sure that...
Restoring merit to medicine.
Making sure that medical students and doctors are selected and promoted based on the merit. And that not based on the color of their skin or the melanin content of their skin, as well as in the provisioning of healthcare as well. We've fought some recent guidelines that have come out that have suggested that we should consider who receives kidney donation based on the color of their skin, not based on other medical factors.
Can you imagine? Yeah.
Yes. So we're trying to restore merit and restore sanity back to medicine.
Oh, wow. What a beautiful mission and so necessary. I want to just talk about the fact, too, because what do you do? How are you helping the doctors that take this oath to care for the sick?
Yeah.
And then they have to participate in mutilating a child. How frustrating it is. I mean, it's frustrating for teachers, it's frustrating for a lot of people in a lot of industries, but boy, can you imagine the medical?
Yes, and we've seen this, unfortunately, in both medicine and mental health, where we have these state governing boards that come in and say, if you don't practice this so-called affirmation model of care, that we're going to take your license and your livelihood away from you. And that's what's very scary.
Yeah.
This threat. We don't see this in any other area of medicine, right? Yes. If I have an anorexic girl that comes in to see me, I don't immediately say to her, yes, you're overweight, let's get you on some Ozempic, let's get you to the surgeon to do a gastric bypass. No, what we do is
we help
patients deal with reality.
Right.
And
obviously there's a lot of psychological issues. A lot of parents know that right on the forefront, but then somehow it becomes a gender issue.
Right. We know that these kids are suffering. They're suffering with whether it be depression, anxiety, whether they have a history of physical or sexual abuse, whether they're on the autism spectrum.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think we get so miscategorized that we, you know, we get called transphobes all the time. And we have nothing against these children. In fact, we really want to help these children.
Sure.
But these radical ideologues are not helping these children. They're, you know, inculcating them into this cult and mutilating them.
I just had Chloe Coles on the show.
Oh.
I mean, what an example of someone
what
who...
What a brave girl. Oh, my gosh. She
what
is...
What a voice and what an example of what can happen to you when you fear-monger the parents.
Yes.
That your child's going to just basically kill themselves, and then you affirm a child who is confused and has, like she said, I had all kinds of issues. And the gender was never,
yes,
fixing
yes.
my sex was never
no,
going to fix me.
That's never going to fix anyone, right?
Right?
Puberty is a tough time for everyone. We all know that. And thankfully, we have wonderful, skilled mental health professionals that can help people deal with this and deal with reality and biology. But we need to unshackle them and allow them to do that. Allow them to,
that's so true.
Affirm reality. We don't affirm patients' delusions. We don't provide medical care at the threat of suicide. We help people in the here and now, live in reality.
So if somebody comes to Do No Harm, what services would you provide? How would you help them?
Yeah, so our main focus, we're a medical organization. Our main focus.
How many members?
So we started just over 3 years ago. We're up at 16,000 members, which has been just tremendous growth.
A mix of tremendous medical growth. Professionals, parents.
Yeah, about 50% medical professionals, nurses, doctors, physical therapists. We have policymakers, parents, members of the public. Media, we run the gamut. Our membership is open to everyone, and we welcome everyone to join us. We provide a lot of support for our medical professionals who are being forced either by their state licensing board or by their employer or institution to do certain things to affirm this care, to practice this new racism under this DEI mantra. We support them. We're also very active legally filing civil rights complaints and lawsuits against these institutions that discriminate. We see a lot of discriminatory scholarships, for instance, scholarships for doctors or future doctors or
a lot of discrimination.
That are open to people of certain races or sexual orientations only. And that's not what America's built on.
Right.
That's a direct
violation.
It is
a land
violation.
Of opportunity for all.
It is. And again, we should be judging people on their merits,
right.
What they bring to the table.
Their expertise.
Yes.
Their qualifications.
Yes.
So are you seeing less doctors going into the industry because of this or getting frustrated and leaving? I'm curious. We've seen that in education.
It's a huge issue. We have a shortage of medical providers, not just doctors, but advanced practice practitioners, nurse practitioners and PAs, nurses. So we have a huge shortage in healthcare. Nationwide, and this is certainly not helping, right?
No.
Pushing an ideology and forcing people to comply to that ideology mm-hmm. is not helping our problem with a shortage of healthcare providers.
It reminds me of, and I'm not sure where this lies right now, but when doctors were being forced to do abortions and offer that service, again, they were like, this is not the oath that I have taken. I should still be able to be a doctor and care for the sick and nurture, but they were being forced to include this. It's kind of the same thing rebranded now with mutilating the children.
Yeah, doctors should be able to take the best care of the patient they have in front of them and follow their own conscience and
right.
personal beliefs and religious beliefs and should not be forced to do certain things, nor should they be prevented from affirming reality.
Affirming, right. And this is the key that's missing, right?
It is.
Yeah. And so where do we go with that? Is that a legislation? What are you guys looking at as far as answers for this? I mean, obviously President Trump signed a great executive order that is helping, but it's only federal funding, but although we hope that catches on.
Yes. No, you're very, very true there. I mean, there's a multi-pronged approach here. Trump made this both of our issues, combating this racist DEI as well as protecting children here, a day one priority with his executive order. So unfortunately, we've had two, ideological judges who have put the law and what's right and the science behind their personal ideology in both Maryland and in Washington State. So we know that that executive order on the child gender front has a temporary stay, but we're very confident.
I'm pretty confident they're going to figure that out.
Yes. So that restricted federal funding through both TRICARE, which is our active duty military, that covers 2 million dependents, right?
Wow.
2 million minors. VA funding, Medicare, and Medicaid across all 50 states. And then what it also does is it covers any institution that receives federal funding. Whether or not that funding is for so-called gender-affirming care, it covers all institutions that receive NIH funding.
Okay.
And so we saw a lot of very quick changes with that. We saw a lot of institutions coming out publicly and saying, we're gonna stop doing this to minors. And we were very happy to see that. Unfortunately, as soon as these two judges ruled on the executive order, we've now seen many I would say most of those hospitals now publicly come out and say, we're going to resume this, unfortunately.
What a back and forth, what a fight this is.
But
what a righteous fight this is to protect our kids that will never be able to be a father or a mother again in their life. And let alone, we don't have any idea what these puberty blockers and these hormones would ever do to somebody that is literally, you know, about to menstruate, switch that whole entire thing around. My gosh, I mean, I would just think it would be cancer and all kinds of things.
And we do know the increased risk of cancer, heart attack, stroke, blood clots, which can travel to the lungs and be fatal. We know that puberty blockers stop bone development, stop brain development.
So how can we champion this as a doctor or as a parent? I don't get it, and I know it's very complicated, and we're not going to get to the answer of it here, but thank you for doing what you're doing. Thank you for being a resource. Again, let our moms know about Do No Harm, what the website is, and how you can help them.
It is donoharmmedicine.org, donoharmmedicine.org. And we welcome moms, parents, members of the public to join us there. We've also got our Stop the Harm database where we've cataloged the hospitals across the country that are performing this, you know, this mutilative so-called care. And that's at stoptheharmdatabase.com.
Well, thank you. Thank you for
you
the work
so
that
much.
You're doing.
Thank you.
Again, moms, you can check out all of this information at donoharmmedicine.org. Thank you so much for all the hard work that you're doing. Thank you for holding the medical field accountable. As you can tell, the theme of today's program is about medical responsibility. And unfortunately, it's also about medical irresponsibility. Now, our final interview is with retired Air Force Major Tom Haviland. Now, Tom spent 20 years in the Air Force, and then he spent another 16 years as a contractor with the Air Force. Unfortunately, he lost his contract when he refused to get the COVID-19 vaccine after reading a lot of concerning studies about the efficacy of the vaccine and also possible side effects. Now, years later, Tom, he's on a mission. He is revealing startling research about never-before-seen blood clots that embalmers have been finding in the deceased. It's an amazing story. Here we go.
How did you get interested in this?
I love math, and I'm a bean counter by trade, an analyzer. And I watched that movie Died Suddenly when it came out in November of 2022.
Oh,
it's about an hour-long documentary, and people could still find it on Rumble. And about half that film was devoted to these six or seven embalmers that said they were seeing unusual white fibrous clots in their corpses, in the veins and arteries of their corpses.
The embalmers are seeing this happen.
Yes. In veins and arteries. And they have 20 or 30 years of experience, and they've never seen these white fibrous clots before. Here's a little bit more of a spectacular example of one for the camera.
I mean, it is shocking when you show this. And again, these are the white blood clots.
And they have
that
20
they're
or 30,
extracting.
Yes, they have 20 or 30 years of experience, Deb, and they've never seen these before. Traditionally, embalmers have seen what's called grape jelly clots. They look like just like dark grape jelly. They dissolve easily.
That would
in their
be
hands.
More typical.
More typical.
Okay.
And they have also seen in the past something called chicken fat clots, which are yellowish in color, much smaller, and they tear very easily. These things, though, are large, they're rubbery, they're very tough, they won't break down. So they started seeing this phenomenon in 2021, which is an interesting year.
All right, put that down here now.
Because if you remember, something happened in 2021, right?
Yeah.
In terms of people were mandated to take a certain medical intervention in the year 2021. So after watching that movie, I contacted the Ohio Embalmers Association. They're located in Cincinnati, Ohio. I live in Dayton.
Okay.
And I...
Something wasn't sitting right with you. You were like, I want more on this.
Yes, I wasn't sure whether these six or seven embalmers were a bunch of kooks or not.
Right.
So I contacted the Ohio Embalmers Association, and lo and behold, when I talked to the now president of the Ohio Embalmers Association, Mr. Woody Wilson, who runs his own funeral home in Marysville, Ohio, about an hour north of where I live, and he does his own embalming, he said, Tom, I'm finding the white fibrous clots too. So now I had a well-respected officer, the president of the Ohio Embalmers Association for the entire state, corroborating these six or seven embalmers in this Died Suddenly movie. So right then and there, I decided I needed to do a survey, a nationwide survey, which I then turned into a worldwide survey by including Canada, UK, Australia, New Zealand, to see how prevalent this phenomenon was.
Okay, how do you just decide to do a worldwide survey? And how do you get people to participate?
It's a trick, I'll tell you that. Good question, Deb. I worked with a friend of mine in northeastern Ohio, a woman named Laura Kasner.
Okay.
And she runs a Substack, by the way, where you can see all of my work. It's laurakasner.substack.com.
Okay.
And we have a Substack we affectionately call Clottastrophe. It's free. There's no charge to subscribe.
Clottastrophe. Wow.
But she just happens to be an expert in SurveyMonkey. So we developed a survey of about 10 questions in SurveyMonkey, and we've done it for the last 3 years. And then I sent it out. I distributed it using a two-prong approach. I used a top-down approach.
Who are you going to, embalmers?
I'm sending it to funeral director associations. Like here in the United States, I sent it to the top 30 U.S. states by population.
Okay.
So, states like Ohio, Texas, and Florida, red states, but also blue states like California, Illinois, Massachusetts, New York. To their state funeral director associations, asking each with hundreds of members underneath them, asking them to please forward the survey down to their active embalmer members to take the survey. I also used a bottom-up approach. I looked up the email addresses for over 1,700 funeral homes around the world, and I sent the email with the link to the survey to them directly, asking them to take the survey.
Okay, so you're busy. You're pretty committed to getting to getting feedback.
And I made sure that these surveys were unbiased. For example, in none of my surveys, all three of them, do I ever mention the words COVID or COVID vaccine. I only ask the embalmers questions they can answer, like what are you seeing, when did you see it, and
had you ever seen this before?
Had you ever seen this before?
Right.
And the embalmers, when they responded to my first survey, they said that a few of them said they saw the white fibrous clots in the year 2020, which is interesting. That's the year that we had COVID, but no vaccines yet. So it means the COVID virus could cause this phenomenon itself. Because we know there's a spike protein on the surface of the virus.
Correct.
But we also know that the vaccine produces the spike protein.
Right. It's a double.
And there was an explosion of embalmers in 2021, starting in 2021, seeing this phenomenon. So just a few saw it in 2020, but then there was an explosion in 2021 of embalmers.
So it's not hard to deduct.
Right.
Right.
That it's a spike protein problem, regardless of where that comes from, right? Whether it comes from the virus or the vaccine.
So, and then someone would say the combination of both.
Or the combination of both.
Right.
Correct. So what's startling is in my most recent survey, I had 301 embalmers from around the world respond to my latest survey. Would have liked to have gotten more, but 301 is enough to say, Houston, we have a problem. Because out of those, Deb, 250, 83% said they're still seeing these white fibrous clots in the year 2024.
Wow.
And the next question I asked, well, what percentage of your corpses contain these clots? 27% of one out of every four corpses has these white fibrous clots in them.
Wow.
They're also seeing another phenomenon. About 80% of the embalmers also said they're seeing a phenomenon called microclotting. Now, they don't describe it as that.
Okay.
They call it coffee grounds. As they're draining the blood off the corpse and trying to get the formaldehyde in, they see what looks like coffee grounds in the drainage of the blood.
Okay. I don't know any of this. This is like...
Well, it's
so foreign to me.
And the microclotting can be just as dangerous as these white fibrous clots that we think are causing strokes and heart attacks. The microclotting occurs at the capillary level, your very small blood vessels, and it can block the exchange of oxygen at the lungs and then the carrying of that oxygen to all the major organs of your body, including your brain, your eyes, for example. So it can be just as dangerous a phenomenon. And the embalmers are seeing that in 22% of their corpses now. This is a phenomenon they did see in the past before COVID, but in less than 5% of their corpses, typically in patients that had heavy chemotherapy. But now that's at least a quadrupling of that effect. These things they never saw prior to 2020.
Somehow I'm seeing you with a graph showing all of the growth, the steady rise. What are you doing with all this information?
Every year when I have the survey done, I send it to the FDA, CDC, and NIH. And would you know, for the 3 years that I've done the survey, not a single time has any of them reached out to me. No contact whatsoever from the FDA, CDC, or NIH. They're ignoring the problem. We know.
What's your goal then?
My goal is to just keep talking about this topic until eventually we can get the vaccines taken off the market. Because I think there's strong evidence that they're involved in the causation of these clots, as well as other things like myocarditis, turbo cancers, miscarriages, nerve damage, etc.
Fertility issues. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, we did. We've covered the topic a lot. with a lot of data, a lot of question around the vaccine. What do you think about the Trump administration with all this?
Well, I'm hopeful. I'm in contact with RFK Jr.
Good.
And Peter McCullough and some of the people that are really big in the movement.
Exactly, right. They had a lot of questions about it.
So and actually RFK Jr. interviewed Mr. Richard Hirschman, who's one of the embalmers in the Die Sunday movie. So Bobby knows him. So we're very hopeful that, knowing about this, he'll push kind of hard to, and he's already talking about the trial data and the test data, you know, that Pfizer and Moderna did was not sufficient enough to catch these side effects. So my hope is that he will eventually take these off the market after seeing that, they haven't done their due diligence in making sure that the vaccines are a safe product.
So when I've interviewed Mr. Kennedy myself too about, just America's health and the vaccines and everything. And his point is, and I think this is what your message is, ask a lot of questions, don't trust something that's new and that's not tested, and that we're demanding transparency and we're demanding good science.
Yes. And it's a mom issue because
it is.
Moms, they sent little kids off to elementary school, they had to wear masks. They sent, teenagers were being offered the jabs. College students were being required.
They're giving them $500 or free bagels or whatever the heck they're doing.
Yes. I have two college students, age college, and my two young children took the jabs.
Oh.
To go to here. I told them, please try to get a religious exemption. They said, Dad, I don't want to hassle with that. So they went ahead and they took the jabs anyways.
Yeah, they were all forced to.
And they were all forced to. And a lot of the universities kept that on for a long time before most of them now have finally removed the mandates, thank goodness.
Yeah, and President Trump's going to remove those too. Oh, he just did. Mandates.
He's put a federal ban of federal money on any
executive order. Yeah.
Executive order for any university or K-12 that mandates the COVID-19 vaccine. So that to me is telling me that President Trump knows there's something wrong with these jabs.
Yeah.
Because he's also invited the military back in, 8,000 military who are separated.
Well, he never said that anybody should be forced. I think they developed that vaccine. We weren't in the inner workings of it. And I think now that there's a lot of questions about it, and that's okay. It's okay to have questions.
And I actually know a lot of moms now that are actually, since they're now hesitant about the COVID vaccine, it makes them hesitant about the other vaccines as well, the childhood schedule.
So, well, look at what they've done with the childhood schedule. I mean, it was what, a quarter of it, back in the 60s to now it's like
72 shots.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
And you talked to RFK Jr. and he's shown a possible link between this
autism, ADHD.
And autism. Exactly.
So something has happened. Something has happened. Our children are very sick.
Yes.
Americans are very sick. So whatever the combination is, please, Lord, let's get it squared away. Let's have full transparency. Let's have the best science we can. Thank you for exposing this. Thank you for talking about it. And any final words to our moms?
Moms, trust your gut instincts. If you think your children's God-given immune system is good enough to handle these childhood illnesses, there's no need for vaccination. So that's my last message to moms. Be brave. Say no if you want to say no.
All right, moms, as we heard today, there is a theme. Moms know best. Dads know best. These are our children. We will do everything we can to protect and guide them. If you have concerns about a vaccine, investigate it. You do what's best for your kids. If they start talking to you about their gender, their sexual orientation, they're getting this information from school, push back, pull them out, rearrange it all. Mamas know best. And that's why we are here as Moms for America, to help support you and give you the support that you need. Again, we have everything, momsforamerica.us, everything that you can imagine on gender ideology, on vaccines, on screen time, on just affirming and teaching your kids. You have the most important job as a mom. You are their greatest influencer. So we're here again to help you moms at momsforamerica.us. All righty. We say we have it all, like I said, from the kitchen table to Congress, from parental rights to public policy. Please check us out at momsforamerica.us. We so appreciate you, moms. You're doing a great job. And together, we're going to keep changing our country. How are we going to do that? We're going to do that one home at a time. God bless. A special thank you to our sponsors, the Herzog Foundation and TUVU. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of the Herzog Foundation.